question of God, immortality and freedom would have been either decided long ago or would very soon be brought to a conclusion. But in general, the uprightness of the defense stands in an inverse ratio to the goodness of the cause, and perhaps more honesty and fairness are shown by those who deny than by those who uphold these doctrines. I shall persuade myself, then, that I have readers who do not wish to see a righteous cause defended by unfair arguments. Such will now recognize the fact that, according to the principles of this critique, if we consider not what is, but what ought to be the case, there can be really no polemic of pure reason. For how can two persons dispute about a thing, the reality of which neither can present in actual or even in possible experience? Each adopts the plan of meditating on his idea for the purpose of drawing from the idea, if he can, what is more than the idea, that is, the reality of the object which it indicates. How shall they settle the dispute, since neither is able to make his assertions directly comprehensible and certain, but must restrict himself to attacking and confuting those of his opponent? All statements enounced by pure reason transcend the conditions of possible experience, beyond the sphere of which we can discover no criterion of truth, while they are at the same time framed in accordance with the laws of the understanding, which are applicable only to experience. And thus it is the fate of all such speculative discussions that while the one party attacks the weaker side of his opponent, he infallibly lays open his own weaknesses. The critique of pure reason may be regarded as the highest tribunal for all speculative disputes, for it is not involved in these disputes which have an immediate relation to certain objects, and not to the laws of the mind, but is instituted for the purpose of determining the rights and limits of reason. Without the control of criticism, reason is, as it were, in a state of nature, and can only establish its claims and assertions by war. Criticism, on the contrary, deciding all questions according to the fundamental laws of its own institution, secures to us the peace of law and order, and enables us to discuss all differences in the more tranquil manner of a legal process. In the former case, disputes are ended by victory, which both sides may claim, and which is followed by a hollow armistice. In the latter, by a sentence, which, as it strikes at the root of all speculative differences, ensures to all concerned a lasting peace. The endless disputes of a dogmatizing reason compel us to look for some mode of arriving at a settled decision by a critical investigation of reason itself. Just as Hobbes maintains that the state of nature is a state of injustice and violence, and that we must leave it and submit ourselves to the constraint of law, which indeed limits individual freedom, but only that it may consist with the freedom of others and with the common good of all. This freedom will, among other things, permit of our openly stating the difficulties and doubts which we are ourselves unable to solve, without being decried on that account as turbulent and dangerous citizens. This privilege forms part of the native rights of human reason, which recognizes no other judge than the universal reason of humanity. And as this reason is the source of all progress and improvement, such a privilege is to be held sacred and inviolable. It is unwise, moreover, to denounce as dangerous any bold assertions against or rash attacks upon an opinion which is held by the largest and most moral class of the community, for that would be giving them an importance which they do not deserve. When I hear that the freedom of the will, the hope of a future life, and the existence of God have been overthrown by the arguments of some able writer, I feel a strong desire to read his book, for I expect that he will add to my knowledge and impart greater clearness and distinctness to my views by the argumentative power shown in his writings. But I am perfectly certain, even before I have opened the book, that he has not succeeded in a single point. Not because I believe I am in possession of irrefutable demonstrations of these important propositions, but because this transcendental critique, which has disclosed to me the power and the limits of pure reason, has fully convinced me that, as it is insufficient to establish the affirmative, it is as powerless, and even more so, to assure us of the truth of the negative answer to these questions. From what source does this free thinker derive his knowledge that there is, for example, no supreme being? This proposition lies out of the field of possible experience, and therefore beyond the limits of human cognition. But I would not read at all the answers which the dogmatical maintainer of the good cause makes to his opponent, because I know well beforehand that he will merely attack the fallacious grounds of his adversary without being able to establish his own assertions. Besides, a new illusory argument, in the construction of which talents and acuteness are shown, is suggestive of new ideas and new trains of reasoning, and in this respect the old and everyday sophistries are quite useless. Again, the dogmatical opponent of religion gives employment to criticism and enables us to test and correct its principles while there is no occasion for anxiety in regard to the influence and results of his reasoning. But, it will be said, must we not warn the youth entrusted to academical care against such writings? Must we not preserve them from the knowledge of these dangerous assertions until their judgment is ripened, or rather, until the doctrines which we wish to inculcate are so firmly rooted in their minds as to withstand all attempts at instilling the contrary dogmas, from whatever quarter they may come? If we are to confine ourselves to the dogmatical procedure in the sphere of pure reason, and find ourselves unable to settle such disputes otherwise than by becoming a party in them, and setting counter-assertions against the statements advanced by our opponents, there is certainly no plan more advisable for the moment, but, at the same time, none more absurd and inefficient for the future than this retaining of the youthful mind under guardianship for a time, and thus preserving it, for so long at least, from seduction into error. But when, at a later period, either curiosity or the prevalent fashion of thought places such writings in their hands, will the so-called convictions of their youth stand firm? The young thinker, who has in his armory none but dogmatical weapons with which to resist the attacks of his opponent, and who cannot detect the latent dialectic which lies in his own opinions, as well as in those of the opposite party, sees the advance of illusory arguments and grounds of proof which have the advantage of novelty, against as illusory grounds of proof destitute of this advantage, and which perhaps excite the suspicion that the natural credulity of his youth has been abused by his instructors. He thinks he can find no better means of showing that he has outgrown the discipline of his minority than by despising those well-meant warnings, and, knowing no system of thought but that of dogmatism, he drinks deep draughts of the poison that is to sap the principles in which his early years were trained. Exactly the opposite of the system here recommended ought to be pursued in academical instruction. This can only be effected, however, by a thorough training in the critical investigation of pure reason. For, in order to bring the principles of this critique into exercise as soon as possible, and to demonstrate their perfect sufficiency, even in the presence of the highest degree of dialectical illusion, the student ought to examine the assertions made on both sides of speculative questions, step by step, and to test them by these principles. It cannot be a difficult task for him to show the fallacies inherent in these propositions, and thus he begins early to feel his own power of securing himself against the influence of such sophistical arguments, which must finally lose for him all their illusory power. And, although the same blows which overturn the edifice of his opponent are as fatal to his own speculative structures, if such he has wished to rear, he need not feel any sorrow in regard to this seeming misfortune, as he has now before him a fair prospect into the practical region in which he may reasonably hope to find a more secure foundation for a rational system. There is, accordingly, no proper polemic in the sphere of pure reason. Both parties beat the air and fight with their own shadows as they pass beyond the limits of nature and can find no tangible point of attack. No firm footing for their dogmatical conflict. Fight as vigorously as they may, the shadows which they hew down immediately start up again, like the heroes in Valhalla, and renew the bloodless and unceasing contest. But neither can we admit that there is any proper skeptical employment of pure reason such as might be based upon the principle of neutrality in all speculative disputes. To excite reason against itself, to place weapons in the hands of the party on the one side as well as in those of the other, and to remain an undisturbed and sarcastic spectator of the fierce struggle that ensues, seems, from the dogmatical point of view, to be a part fitting only a malevolent disposition. But when the sophist evidences an invincible obstinacy and blindness, and a pride which no criticism can moderate, there is no other practicable course than to oppose to this pride and obstinacy similar feelings and pretensions on the other side, equally well or ill-founded, so that reason, staggered by the reflections thus forced upon it, finds it necessary to moderate its confidence in such pretensions and to listen to the advices of criticism. But we cannot stop at these bounds, much less regard the conviction of our ignorance not only as a cure for the conceit natural to dogmatism, but as the settlement of the disputes in which reason is involved with itself. On the contrary, skepticism is merely a means of awaking reason from its dogmatic dreams and exciting it to a more careful investigation of its own powers and pretensions. But as skepticism appears to be the shortest road to a permanent peace in the domain of philosophy, and as it is the track pursued by the many who aim at giving a philosophical colouring to their contemptuous dislike of all inquiries of this kind, I think it necessary to present to my readers this mode of thought in its true light. Skepticism not a permanent state for human reason. The consciousness of ignorance, unless this ignorance is recognized to be absolutely necessary, ought, instead of forming the conclusion of my inquiries, to be the strongest motive to the pursuit of them. All ignorance is either ignorance of things or of the limits of knowledge. If my ignorance is accidental and not necessary, it must incite me, in the first case, to a dogmatical inquiry regarding the objects of which I am ignorant. In the second, to a critical investigation into the bounds of all possible knowledge. But that my ignorance is absolutely necessary and unavoidable, and that it consequently absolves from the duty of all further investigation, is a fact which cannot be made out upon empirical grounds, from observation, but upon critical grounds alone, that is, by a thoroughgoing investigation into the primary sources of cognition. It follows that the determination of the bounds of reason can be made only on a priori grounds, while the empirical limitation of reason, which is merely an indeterminate cognition of an ignorance that can never be completely removed, can take place only a posteriori. In other words, our empirical knowledge is limited by that which yet remains for us to know. The former cognition of our ignorance, which is possible only on a rational basis, is a science. The latter is merely a perception, and we cannot say how far the inferences drawn from it may extend. If I regard the earth, as it really appears to my senses, as a flat surface, I am ignorant of how far this surface extends. But experience teaches me that, how far soever I go, I always see before me a space in which I can proceed further, and thus I know the limits, merely visual, of my actual knowledge of the earth, although I am ignorant of the limits of the earth itself. But if I have got so far as to know that the earth is a sphere, and that its surface is spherical, I can cognize a priori and determine upon principles, from my knowledge of a small part of this surface, say to the extent of a degree, the diameter and circumference of the earth. And although I am ignorant of the objects which this surface contains, I have a perfect knowledge of its limits and extent. The sum of all the possible objects of our cognition seems to us to be a level surface, with an apparent horizon, that which forms the limit of its extent, and which has been termed by us the idea of unconditioned totality. To reach this limit by empirical means is impossible, and all attempts to determine it a priori according to a principle are alike in vain. But all the questions raised by pure reason relate to that which lies beyond this horizon, or at least in its boundary line. The celebrated David Hume was one of those geographers of human reason who believe that they have given a sufficient answer to all such questions by declaring them to lie beyond the horizon of our knowledge, a horizon which, however, Hume was unable to determine. His attention especially was directed to the principle of causality, and he remarked with perfect justice that the truth of this principle, and even the objective validity of the conception of a cause, was not commonly based upon clear insight, that is, upon a priori cognition. Hence, he concluded that this law does not derive its authority from its universality and necessity, but merely from its general applicability in the course of experience, and a kind of subjective necessity thence arising, which he termed habit. From the inability of reason to establish this principle as a necessary law for the acquisition of all experience, he inferred the nullity of all the attempts of reason to pass the region of the empirical. This procedure of subjecting the factor of reason to examination, and if necessary to disapproval, may be termed the censura of reason. This censura must inevitably lead us to doubts regarding all transcendent employment of principles. But this is only the second step in our inquiry. The first step in regard to the subjects of pure reason, and which marks the infancy of that faculty, is that of dogmatism. The second, which we have just mentioned, is that of scepticism, and it gives evidence that our judgment has been improved by experience. But a third step is necessary, indicative of the maturity and manhood of the judgment, which now lays a firm foundation upon universal and necessary principles. This is the period of criticism in which we do not examine the factor of reason, but reason itself, in the whole extent of its powers, and in regard to its capability of a priori cognition. And thus we determine not merely the empirical and ever-shifting bounds of our knowledge, but its necessary and eternal limits. We demonstrate from indubitable principles not merely our ignorance in respect to this or that subject, but in regard to all possible questions of a certain class. Thus, scepticism is a resting place for reason, in which it may reflect on its dogmatical wanderings, and gain some knowledge of the region in which it happens to be, that it may pursue its way with greater certainty. But it cannot be its permanent dwelling place. It must take up its abode only in the region of complete certitude, whether this relates to the cognition of objects themselves, or to the limits which bound all our cognition. Reason is not to be considered as an indefinitely extended plane, of the bounds of which we have only a general knowledge. It ought rather to be compared to a sphere, the radius of which may be found from the curvature of its surface, that is, the nature of a priori synthetical propositions, and consequently its circumference and extent. Beyond the sphere of experience there are no objects which it can cognize. Nay, even questions regarding such suppositious objects relate only to the subjective principles of a complete determination of the relations which exist between the understanding, conceptions which lie within this sphere. We are actually in possession of a priori synthetical cognitions, as is proved by the existence of the principles of the understanding, which anticipate experience. If anyone cannot comprehend the possibility of these principles, he may have some reason to doubt whether they are really a priori, but he cannot on this account declare them to be impossible and affirm the nullity of the steps which reason may have taken under their guidance. He can only say, if we perceived their origin and their authenticity, we should be able to determine the extent and limits of reason. But, till we can do this, all propositions regarding the latter are mere random assertions. In this view, the doubt respecting all dogmatical philosophy which proceeds without the guidance of criticism is well grounded. But we cannot therefore deny to reason the ability to construct a sound philosophy when the way has been prepared by a thorough critical investigation. All the conceptions produced and all the questions raised by pure reason do not lie in the sphere of experience, but in that of reason itself, and hence they must be solved, and shown to be either valid or inadmissible, by that faculty. We have no right to decline the solution of such problems on the ground that the solution can be discovered only from the nature of things and under pretense of the limitation of human faculties, for reason is the sole creator of all these ideas, and is therefore bound either to establish their validity or to expose their illusory nature. The polemic of skepticism is properly directed against the dogmatist, who erects a system of philosophy without having examined the fundamental objective principles on which it is based, for the purpose of evidencing the futility of his designs, and thus bringing him to a knowledge of his own powers. But in itself, skepticism does not give us any certain information in regard to the bounds of our knowledge. All unsuccessful dogmatical attempts of reason are facia, which it is always useful to submit to the censure of the skeptic. But this cannot help us to any decision regarding the expectations which reason cherishes of better success in future endeavours. The investigations of skepticism cannot therefore settle the dispute regarding the rights and powers of human reason. Hume is perhaps the ablest and most ingenious of all skeptical philosophers, and his writings have undoubtedly exerted the most powerful influence in awakening reason to a thorough investigation into its own powers. It will therefore well repay our labours to consider for a little the course of reasoning which he followed, and the errors into which he strayed, although setting out on the path of truth and certitude. Hume was probably aware, although he never clearly developed the notion, that we proceed in judgments of a certain class beyond our conception of the object. I have termed this kind of judgment synthetical. As regards the manner in which I pass beyond my conception by the aid of experience, no doubts can be entertained. Experience is itself a synthesis of perceptions, and it employs perceptions to increment the conception, which I obtain by means of another perception. But we feel persuaded that we are able to proceed beyond a conception and to extend our cognition a priori. We attempt this in two ways. Either through the pure understanding in relation to that which may become an object of experience, or through pure reason in relation to such properties of things or of the existence of things as can never be presented in any experience. This skeptical philosopher did not distinguish these two kinds of judgments as he ought to have done, but regarded this augmentation of conceptions and, if we may so express ourselves, the spontaneous generation of understanding and reason, independently of the impregnation of experience, as altogether impossible. The so-called a priori principles of these faculties he consequently held to be invalid and imaginary, and regarded them as nothing but subjective habits of thought originating in experience, and therefore purely empirical and contingent rules to which we attribute a spurious necessity and universality. In support of this strange assertion, he referred us to the generally acknowledged principle of the relation between cause and effect. No faculty of the mind can conduct us from the conception of a thing to the existence of something else, and hence he believed he could infer that, without experience, we possess no source from which we can augment a conception, and no ground sufficient to justify us in framing a judgment that is to extend our cognition a priori. That the light of the sun which shines upon a piece of wax at the same time melts it while it hardens clay, no power of the understanding could infer from the conceptions which we previously possessed of these substances. Much less is there any a priori law that could conduct us to such a conclusion, which experience alone can certify. On the other hand, we have seen in our discussion of transcendental logic that although we can never proceed immediately beyond the content of the conception which is given us, we can always cognize completely a priori, in relation, however, to a third term, namely possible experience, the law of its connection with other things. For example, if I observe that a piece of wax melts, I can cognize a priori that there must have been something, the sun's heat, proceeding, which this effect follows according to a fixed law. Although, without the aid of experience, I could not cognize a priori and in a determinate manner either the cause from the effect or the effect from the cause. Hume was therefore wrong in inferring from the contingency of the determination according to law the contingency of the law itself. And the passing beyond the conception of a thing to possible experience, which is an a priori proceeding constituting the objective reality of the conception, he confounded with our synthesis of objects in actual experience, which is always, of course, empirical. Thus, too, he regarded the principle of affinity, which has its seat in the understanding and indicates a necessary connection as a mere rule of association, lying in the imitative faculty of imagination, which can present only contingent and not objective connections. The skeptical errors of this remarkably acute thinker arose principally from a defect which was common to him with the dogmatists, namely, that he had never made a systematic review of all the different kinds of a priori synthesis performed by the understanding. Had he done so, he would have found, to take one example among many, that the principle of permanence was of this character, and that it, as well as the principle of causality, anticipates experience. In this way, he might have been able to describe the determinate limits of the a priori operations of understanding and reason. But he merely declared the understanding to be limited, instead of showing what its limits were. He created a general mistrust in the power of our faculties without giving us any determinate knowledge of the bounds of our necessary and unavoidable ignorance. He examined and condemned some of the principles of the understanding without investigating all its powers with the completeness necessary to criticism. He denies, with truth, certain powers to the understanding, but he goes further and declares it to be utterly inadequate to the a priori extension of knowledge, although he has not fully examined all the powers which reside in the faculty. And thus, the fate which always overtakes skepticism meets him too. That is to say, his own declarations are doubted, for his objections were raised upon facta, which are contingent, and not upon principles, which can alone demonstrate the necessary invalidity of all dogmatical assertions. As Hume makes no distinction between the well-grounded claims of the understanding and the dialectical pretensions of reason, against which, however, his attacks are mainly directed, reason does not feel itself shut out from all attempts at the extension of a priori cognition, and hence it refuses, in spite of a few checks in this or that quarter, to relinquish such efforts. For one naturally arms oneself to resist an attack, and becomes more obstinate in the resolve to establish the claims he has advanced. But a complete review of the powers of reason, and the conviction thence arising that we are in possession of a limited field of action, while we must admit the vanity of higher claims, puts an end to all doubt and dispute, and induces reason to rest satisfied with the undisturbed possession of its limited domain. To the uncritical dogmatist who has not surveyed the sphere of his understanding, nor determined, in accordance with principles, the limits of possible cognition, who consequently is ignorant of his own powers, and believes he will discover them by the attempts he makes in the field of cognition, these attacks of skepticism are not only dangerous, but destructive. For if there is one proposition in his chain of reasoning which he cannot prove, or the fallacy in which he cannot evolve in accordance with the principle, suspicion falls on all his statements, however plausible they may appear. And thus, skepticism, the bane of dogmatical philosophy, conducts us to a sound investigation into the understanding and the reason. When we are thus far advanced, we need fear no further attacks. For the limits of our domain are clearly marked out, and we can make no claims nor become involved in any disputes regarding the region that lies beyond these limits. Thus, the skeptical procedure in philosophy does not present any solution of the problems of reason, but it forms an excellent exercise for its powers, awakening its circumspection and indicating the means whereby it may most fully establish its claims to its legitimate possessions. Section 3. The Discipline of Pure Reason in Hypothesis. This critique of reason has now taught us that all its efforts to extend the bounds of knowledge by means of pure speculation are utterly fruitless. So much the wider field, it may appear, lies open to hypothesis, as where we cannot know with certainty, we are at liberty to make guesses and to form suppositions. Imagination may be allowed, under the strict surveillance of reason, to invent suppositions, but these must be based on something that is perfectly certain, and that is the possibility of the object. If we are well assured upon this point, it is allowable to have recourse to supposition in regard to the reality of the object. But this supposition must, unless it is utterly groundless, be connected as its ground of explanation with that which is really given and absolutely certain. Such a supposition is termed a hypothesis. It is beyond our power to form the least conception a priori of the possibility of dynamical connection in phenomena, and the category of the pure understanding will not enable us to excogitate any such connection, but merely helps us to understand it when we meet with it in experience. For this reason, we cannot, in accordance with the categories, imagine or invent any object or any property of an object not given, or that may not be given in experience, and employ it in a hypothesis. Otherwise, we should be basing our chain of reasoning upon mere chimerical fancies, and not upon conceptions of things. Thus, we have no right to assume the existence of new powers not existing in nature. For example, an understanding with a non-sensuous intuition, a force of attraction without contact, or some new kind of substances occupying space, and yet without the property of impenetrability. And consequently, we cannot assume that there is any other kind of community among substances than that observable in experience, any kind of presence than that in space, or any kind of duration than that in time. In one word, the conditions of possible experience are, for reason, the only conditions of the possibility of things. Reason cannot venture to form, independently of these conditions, any conception of things, because such conceptions, although not self-contradictory, are without object and without application. The conceptions of reason are, as we have already shown, mere ideas, and do not relate to any object in any kind of experience. At the same time, they do not indicate imaginary or possible objects. They are purely problematical in their nature, and as aids to the heuristic exercise of the faculties, form the basis of the regulative principles for the systematic employment of the understanding in the field of experience. If we leave this ground of experience, they become mere fictions of thought, the possibility of which is quite indemonstrable, and they cannot consequently be employed as hypotheses in the explanation of real phenomena. It is quite admissible to cogitate the soul as simple for the purpose of enabling ourselves to employ the idea of a perfect and necessary unity of all the faculties of the mind as the principle of all our inquiries into its internal phenomena, although we cannot cognize this unity in concreto. But to assume that the soul is a simple substance, a transcendental conception, would be announcing a proposition which is not only indemonstrable, as many physical hypotheses are, but a proposition which is purely arbitrary and in the highest degree rash. The simple is never presented in experience, and if by substance is here meant the permanent object of sensuous intuition, the possibility of a simple phenomenon is perfectly inconceivable. Reason affords no good grounds for admitting the existence of intelligible beings or of intelligible properties of sensuous things, although, as we have no conception either of their possibility or of their impossibility, it will always be out of our power to affirm dogmatically that they do not exist. In the explanation of given phenomena, no other things and no other grounds of explanation can be employed than those which stand in connection with the given phenomena according to the known laws of experience. A transcendental hypothesis in which a mere idea of reason is employed to explain the phenomena of nature would not give us any better insight into a phenomenon, as we should be trying to explain what we do not sufficiently understand from known empirical principles by what we do not understand at all. The principle of such a hypothesis might conduce to the satisfaction of reason, but it would not assist the understanding in its application to objects. Order and conformity to aims in the sphere of nature must be themselves explained upon natural grounds and according to natural laws, and the wildest hypotheses, if they are only physical, are here more admissible than a hyperphysical hypothesis such as that of a divine author. For such a hypothesis would introduce the principle of ignava ratio, which requires us to give up the search for causes that might be discovered in the course of experience, and to rest satisfied with a mere idea. As regards the absolute totality of the grounds of explanation in the series of these causes, this can be no hindrance to the understanding in the case of phenomena. Because, as they are to us nothing more than phenomena, we have no right to look for anything like completeness in the synthesis of the series of their conditions. Transcendental hypotheses are therefore inadmissible, and we cannot use the liberty of employing in the absence of physical, hyperphysical grounds of explanation. And this for two reasons. First, because such hypotheses do not advance reason, but rather stop it in its progress. Secondly, because this license would render fruitless all its exertions in its own proper sphere, which is that of experience. For when the explanation of natural phenomena happens to be difficult, we have constantly at hand a transcendental ground of explanation, which lifts us above the necessity of investigating nature. And our inquiries are brought to a close not because we have obtained all the requisite knowledge, but because we abut upon a principle which is incomprehensible, and which, indeed, is so far back in the track of thought as to contain the conception of the absolutely primal being. The next requisite for the admissibility of a hypothesis is its sufficiency. That is, it must determine a priori the consequences which are given in experience, and which are supposed to follow from the hypothesis itself. If we require to employ auxiliary hypotheses, the suspicion naturally arises that they are mere fictions, because the necessity for each of them requires the same justification as in the case of the original hypothesis, and thus their testimony is invalid. If we suppose the existence of an infinitely perfect cause, we possess sufficient grounds for the explanation of the conformity to aims, the order and the greatness which we observe in the universe. But we find ourselves obliged, when we observe the evil in the world and the exceptions to these laws, to employ new hypotheses in support of the original one. We employ the idea of the simple nature of the human soul as the foundation of all the theories we may form of its phenomena. But when we meet with difficulties in our way, when we observe in the soul phenomena similar to the changes which take place in matter, we require to call in new auxiliary hypotheses. These may indeed not be false, but we do not know them to be true, because the only witness to their certitude is the hypothesis which they themselves have been called in to explain. We are not discussing the above-mentioned assertions regarding the immaterial unity of the soul and the existence of a supreme being as dogmata, which certain philosophers profess to demonstrate a priori, but purely as hypotheses. In the former case, the dogmatist must take care that his arguments possess the apodictic certainty of a demonstration. For the assertion that the reality of such ideas is probable is as absurd as a proof of the probability of a proposition in geometry. Pure abstract reason, apart from all experience, can either cognize a proposition entirely a priori and as necessary, or it can cognize nothing at all. And hence the judgments it announces are never mere opinions. They are either apodictic certainties or declarations that nothing can be known on the subject. Opinions and probable judgments on the nature of things can only be employed to explain given phenomena, or they may relate to the effect, in accordance with empirical laws, of an actually existing cause. In other words, we must restrict the sphere of opinion to the world of experience and nature. Beyond this region, opinion is mere invention, unless we are groping about for the truth on a path not yet fully known, and have some hopes of stumbling upon it by chance. But although hypotheses are inadmissible in answers to the questions of pure speculative reason, they may be employed in the defense of these answers. That is to say, hypotheses are admissible in polemic, but not in the sphere of dogmatism. By the defense of statements of this character, I do not mean an attempt at discovering new grounds for their support, but merely the refutation of the arguments of opponents. All a priori synthetical propositions possess the peculiarity that, although the philosopher who maintains the reality of the ideas contained in the proposition is not in possession of sufficient knowledge to establish the certainty of his statements, his opponent is as little able to prove the truth of the opposite. This equality of fortune does not allow the one party to be superior to the other in the sphere of speculative cognition, and it is this sphere, accordingly, that is the proper arena of these endless speculative conflicts. But we shall afterwards show that, in relation to its practical exercise, reason has the right of admitting what, in the field of pure speculation, she would not be justified in supposing, except upon perfectly sufficient grounds. Because all such suppositions destroy the necessary completeness of speculation, a condition which the practical reason, however, does not consider to be requisite. In this sphere, therefore, reason is mistress of a possession, her title to which she does not require to prove, which, in fact, she could not do. The burden of proof accordingly rests upon the opponent. But as he has just as little knowledge regarding the subject discussed, and is as little able to prove the non-existence of the object of an idea as the philosopher on the other side is to demonstrate its reality, it is evident that there is an advantage on the side of the philosopher who maintains his position as a practically necessary supposition, melior est conditio possidentis. For he is at liberty to employ, in self-defense, the same weapons as his opponent makes use of in attacking him. That is, he has a right to use hypotheses not for the purpose of supporting the arguments in favor of his own propositions, but to show that his opponent knows no more than himself regarding the subject under discussion, and cannot boast of any speculative advantage. Hypotheses are therefore admissible in the sphere of pure reason only as weapons for the self-defense, and not as supports to dogmatical assertions. But the opposing party we must always seek for in ourselves. For speculative reason is, in the sphere of transcendentalism, dialectical in its own nature. The difficulties and objections we have to fear lie in ourselves. They are like old but never superannuated claims, and we must seek them out and settle them once and forever if we are to expect a permanent peace. External tranquility is hollow and unreal. The root of these contradictions, which lies in the nature of human reason, must be destroyed, and this can only be done by giving it, in the first instance, freedom to grow, nay, by nourishing it, that it may send out shoots and thus betray its own existence. It is our duty, therefore, to try to discover new objections, to put weapons in the hands of our opponent, and to grant him the most favorable position in the arena that he can wish. We have nothing to fear from these concessions. On the contrary, we may rather hope that we shall thus make ourselves master of a possession which no one will ever venture to dispute. The thinker requires, to be fully equipped, the hypotheses of pure reason, which, although but leaden weapons, for they have not been steeled in the armory of experience, are as useful as any that can be employed by his opponents. If, accordingly, we have assumed from a non-speculative point of view the immaterial nature of the soul, and are met by the objection that experience seems to prove that the growth and decay of our mental faculties are mere modifications of the sensuous organism, we can weaken the force of this objection by the assumption that the body is nothing but the fundamental phenomenon, to which, as a necessary condition, all sensibility, and consequently all thought, relates in the present state of our existence, and that the separation of soul and body forms the conclusion of the sensuous exercise of our power of cognition and the beginning of the intellectual. The body would, in this view of the question, be regarded not as the cause of thought, but merely as its restrictive condition, as promotive of the sensuous and animal, but as a hindrance to the pure and spiritual life, and the dependence of the animal life on the constitution of the body would not prove that the whole life of man was also dependent on the state of the organism. We might go still further and discover new objections, or carry out to their extreme consequences those which have already been adduced. Generation, in the human race as well as among the irrational animals, depends on so many accidents, of occasion of proper sustenance, of the laws enacted by the government of a country, of vice even, that it is difficult to believe in the external existence of a being whose life has begun under circumstances so mean and trivial, and so entirely dependent upon our own control. As regards the continuance of the existence of the whole race, we need have no difficulties, for accident in single cases is subject to general laws. But in the case of each individual, it would seem as if we could hardly expect so wonderful an effect from causes so insignificant. But in answer to these objections, we may adduce the transcendental hypothesis that all life is properly intelligible, and not subject to changes of time, and that it neither began in birth nor will end in death. We may assume that this life is nothing more than a sensuous representation of pure spiritual life, that the whole world of sense is but an image hovering before the faculty of cognition which we exercise in this sphere, and with no more objective reality than a dream, and that if we could intuit ourselves and other things as they really are, we should see ourselves in a world of spiritual natures, our connection with which did not begin at our birth, and will not cease with the destruction of the body, and so on. We cannot be said to know what has been above asserted, nor do we seriously maintain the truth of these assertions, and the notions therein indicated are not even ideas of reason, they are purely fictitious conceptions. But this hypothetical procedure is in perfect conformity with the laws of reason. Our opponent mistakes the absence of empirical conditions for a proof of the complete impossibility of all that we have asserted, and we have to show him that he has not exhausted the whole sphere of possibility, and that he can as little compass that sphere by the laws of experience and nature as we can lay a secure foundation for the operations of reason beyond the region of experience. Such hypothetical defences against the pretensions of an opponent must not be regarded as declarations of opinion. The philosopher abandons them so soon as the opposite party renounces its dogmatical conceit. To maintain a simply negative position in relation to propositions which rest on an insecure foundation well befits the moderation of a true philosopher. But to uphold the objections urged against an opponent as proofs of the opposite statement is a proceeding just as unwarrantable and arrogant as it is to attack the position of a philosopher who advances affirmative propositions regarding such a subject. It is evident, therefore, that hypotheses in the speculative sphere are valid not as independent propositions, but only relatively to opposite transcendent assumptions. For, to make the principles of possible experience conditions of the possibility of things in general is just as transcendent a procedure as to maintain the objective reality of ideas which can be applied to no objects except such as lie without the limits of possible experience. The judgments enounced by pure reason must be necessary, or they must not be announced at all. Reason cannot trouble herself with opinions. But the hypotheses we have been discussing are merely problematical judgments which can neither be confuted nor proved. While, therefore, they are not personal opinions, they are indispensable as answers to objections which are liable to be raised. But we must take care to confine them to this function and guard against any assumption on their part of absolute validity, a proceeding which would involve reason in inextricable difficulties and contradictions. Section 4. The Discipline of Pure Reason in Relation to Proofs. It is a peculiarity which distinguishes the proofs of transcendental synthetical propositions from those of all other a priori synthetical cognitions that reason, in the case of the former, does not apply its conceptions directly to an object, but is first obliged to prove a priori the objective validity of these conceptions and the possibility of their synthesis. This is not merely a prudential rule, it is essential to the very possibility of the proof of a transcendental proposition. If I am required to pass a priori beyond the conception of an object, I find that it is utterly impossible without the guidance of something which is not contained in the conception. In mathematics, it is a priori intuition that guides my synthesis, and in this case, all our conclusions may be drawn immediately from pure intuition. In transcendental cognition, so long as we are dealing only with conceptions of the understanding, we are guided by possible experience. That is to say, a proof in the sphere of transcendental cognition does not show that the given conception, that of an event, for example, leads directly to another conception, that of a cause. For this would be a saltus, which nothing can justify. But it shows that experience itself, and consequently the object of experience, is impossible without the connection indicated by these conceptions. It follows that such a proof must demonstrate the possibility of arriving, synthetically and a priori, at a certain knowledge of things, which was not contained in our conceptions of these things. Unless we pay particular attention to this requirement, our proofs, instead of pursuing the straight path indicated by reason, follow the tortuous road of mere subjective association. The illusory conviction which rests upon subjective causes of association, and which is considered as resulting from the perception of a real and objective natural affinity, is always open to doubt and suspicion. For this reason, all the attempts which have been made to prove the principle of sufficient reason have, according to the universal admission of philosophers, been quite unsuccessful. And before the appearance of transcendental criticism, it was considered better, as this principle could not be abandoned to appeal boldly to the common sense of mankind, a proceeding which always proves that the problem which reason ought to solve is one in which philosophers find great difficulties, rather than attempt to discover new dogmatical proofs. But if the proposition to be proved is a proposition of pure reason, and if I aim at passing beyond my empirical conceptions by the aid of mere ideas, it is necessary that the proof should first show that such a step in synthesis is possible, which it is not, before it proceeds to prove the truth of the proposition itself. The so-called proof of the simple nature of the soul from the unity of apperception is a very plausible one. But it contains no answer to the objection that, as the notion of absolute simplicity is not a conception which is directly applicable to a perception, but is an idea which must be inferred, if at all, from observation, it is by no means evident how the mere fact of consciousness, which is contained in all thought, although in so far a simple representation, can conduct me to the consciousness and cognition of a thing which is purely a thinking substance. When I represent to my mind the power of my body as in motion, my body in this thought is so far absolute unity, and my representation of it is a simple one. And hence I can indicate this representation by the motion of a point, because I have made abstraction of the size or volume of the body. But I cannot hence infer that, given merely the moving power of a body, the body may be cogitated as simple substance, merely because the representation in my mind takes no account of its content in space, and is consequently simple. The simple in abstraction is very different from the objectively simple, and hence the ego, which is simple in the first sense, may, in the second sense, as indicating the soul itself, be a very complex conception with a very various content. Thus it is evident that in all such arguments there lurks a paralogism. We guess, for without some surmise our suspicion would not be excited in reference to a proof of this character, at the presence of the paralogism by keeping ever before us a criterion of the possibility of these synthetical propositions which aim at proving more than experience can teach us. This criterion is obtained from the observation that such proofs do not lead us directly from the subject of the proposition to be proved to the required predicate, but find it necessary to presuppose the possibility of extending our cognition a priori by means of ideas. We must, accordingly, always use the greatest caution. We require, before attempting any proof, to consider how it is possible to extend the sphere of cognition by the operations of pure reason, and from what source we are to derive knowledge which is not obtained from the analysis of conceptions, nor relates by anticipation to possible experience. We shall thus spare ourselves much severe and fruitless labor by not expecting from reason what is beyond its power, or rather by subjecting it to discipline and teaching it to moderate its vehement desires for the extension of the sphere of cognition. The first rule of our guidance is, therefore, not to attempt a transcendental proof before we have considered from what source we are to derive the principles upon which the proof is to be based, and what right we have to expect that our conclusions from these principles will be veracious. If they are principles of the understanding, it is vain to expect that we should attain by their means to ideas of pure reason. For these principles are valid only in regard to objects of possible experience. If they are principles of pure reason, our labor is alike in vain. For the principles of reason, if employed as objective, are without exception dialectical, and possess no validity or truth except as regulative principles of the systematic employment of reason in experience. But when such delusive proofs are presented to us, it is our duty to meet them with a non-lique of a matured judgment, And although we are unable to expose the particular sophism upon which the proof is based, we have a right to demand a deduction of the principles employed in it. And if these principles have their origin in pure reason alone, such a deduction is absolutely impossible. And thus it is unnecessary that we should trouble ourselves with the exposure and confutation of every sophistical illusion. We may at once bring all dialectic, which is inexhaustible in the production of fallacies, before the bar of critical reason, which tests the principles upon which all dialectical procedure is based. The second peculiarity of transcendental proof is that a transcendental proposition cannot rest upon more than a single proof. If I am drawing conclusions not from conceptions but from intuition corresponding to a conception, be it pure intuition as in mathematics or empirical as in natural science, the intuition which forms the basis of my inferences presents me with materials for many synthetical propositions which I can connect in various modes, while, as it is allowable to proceed from different points in the intention, I can arrive by different paths at the same proposition. But every transcendental proposition sets out from a conception and posits the synthetical condition of the possibility of an object according to this conception. There must, therefore, be but one ground of proof, because it is the conception alone which determines the object. And thus the proof cannot contain anything more than the determination of the object according to the conception. In our transcendental analytic, for example, we inferred the principle, every event has a cause, from the only condition of the objective possibility of our conception of an event. This is, that an event cannot be determined in time and consequently cannot form a part of experience unless it stands under this dynamical law. This is the only possible ground of proof, for our conception of an event possesses objective validity. That is a true conception only because the law of causality determines an object to which it can refer. Other arguments in support of this principle have been attempted, such as that from the contingent nature of a phenomenon. But when this argument is considered, we can discover no criterion of contingency except the fact of an event, of something happening. That is to say, the existence which is preceded by the non-existence of an object, and thus we fall back on the very thing to be proved. If the proposition, every thinking being is simple, is to be proved, we keep to the conception of the ego, which is simple, and to which all thought has a relation. The same is the case with the transcendental proof of the existence of a deity, which is based solely upon the harmony and reciprocal fitness of the conceptions of an ens realissimum and a necessary being, and cannot be attempted in any other manner. This caution serves to simplify very much the criticism of all propositions of reason. When reason employs conceptions alone, only one proof of its thesis is possible, if any. When, therefore, the dogmatist advances with 10 arguments in favour of a proposition, we may be sure that not one of them is conclusive. For if he possessed one which proved the proposition he brings forward to demonstration, as must always be the case with the propositions of pure reason, what need is there for any more? His intention can only be similar to that of the advocate, who had different arguments for different judges. This availing himself of the weakness of those who examine his arguments, who, without going into any profound investigation, adopt the view of the case which seems most probable at first sight, and decide according to it. The third rule for the guidance of pure reason in the conduct of a proof is that all transcendental proofs must never be apagogic or indirect, but always ostensive or direct. The direct or ostensive proof not only establishes the truth of the proposition to be proved, but exposes the grounds of its truth. The apagogic, on the other hand, may assure us of the truth of the proposition, but it cannot enable us to comprehend the grounds of its possibility. The latter is, accordingly, rather an auxiliary to an argument than a strictly philosophical and rational mode of procedure. In one respect, however, they have an advantage over direct proofs, from the fact that the mode of arguing by contradiction which they employ renders our understanding of the question more clear and approximates the proof to the certainty of an intuitional demonstration. The true reason why direct proofs are employed in different sciences is this. When the grounds upon which we seek to base a cognition are too various or too profound, we try whether or not we may not discover the truth of our cognition from its consequences. The modus ponens of reasoning from the truth of its inferences to the truth of a proposition would be inadmissible if all the inferences that can be drawn from it are known to be true. For in this case, there can be only one possible ground for these inferences, and that is the true one. But this is a quite impracticable procedure, as it surpasses all our powers to discover all the possible inferences that can be drawn from a proposition. But this mode of reasoning is employed, under favour, when we wish to prove the truth of a hypothesis, in which case we admit the truth of the conclusion, which is supported by analogy,